I'm Frank Holland, and you're listening to CNBC's Worldwide Exchange. Our show is live weekdays at 5 a.m. Eastern. Listen in. It is 5 a.m. here at CNBC Global Headquarters, and here is your 5 at 5. We start with Wall Street looking to get back on track after its worst day in nearly a month. Why our Jim Cramer says it's more of a market top than a bubble about to burst. And while it may not be a bubble, there is nothing pretty about the Mag 7 shedding more than $200 billion in market cap in one single day. The big question today, is this a big tech buying opportunity? And record high and record slide tracking the action of Bitcoin this morning after the brief moment when it achieved new highs. Plus, OpenAI firing back at Elon Musk and his lawsuit and the very ethos of the Microsoft-backed startup. And then later in the show, a big night for President Biden, former President Trump, in Super Tuesday's primary battle. There's also word that Mr. Trump is trying to attract wealthy donors, and he had a reported meeting with one of the richest people in the world. It is Wednesday, March the 6th, 2024. You are watching Worldwide Exchange right here on CNBC. Good morning. Welcome to Worldwide Exchange. I'm Frank Collins. Get you ready for the trading day ahead. As always, we're going to kick off the hour with a check of U.S. stock futures and take a look. Big difference from what we saw yesterday in the green across the board right now in the pre-market. Looks like the Dow would open up about 85 points higher. Okay, what we're seeing here, big turnaround from what we saw yesterday. The market's coming off their worst day since February the 13th, with all the major averages shedding 1% or more. We're showing you some of the action on the big board right here. You're seeing the declines. It was even worse for the Mag 7. If you leave out NVIDIA, the Mag 7 losing a combined $233 billion in market value yesterday. You see the downward moves when it comes to many of the Mag 7 stocks. You see right here, Tesla, the hardest hit, down pretty much 4%. So this big drop, it was one of the factors fueling the broader market sell-off. The $233 billion in market cap, however, just to keep it in perspective, eye-popping number, but only the third largest single-day loss for the group this year. Something to keep in mind. All right, tech trying to regain some of its footing this morning. Right now, we're checking the gainers on the NASDAQ 100. Right at the top, CrowdStrike off of earnings up over 20%, followed by Palo Alto Networks. The report from CrowdStrike helping to pull the entire cybersecurity sector up higher. Four of the top names you're seeing right here are in the cybersecurity sector. Zscaler up more than 4%. Fortinet up over just 3.5%. Okay. We're also checking the bond market this morning ahead of today's Capitol Hill testimony from Fed Chairman Jay Powell. Take a look at yields right here. Let's look at the benchmark at 4.16. It's down about 10 basis points from its high at the start of the month. We've seen that slide. Similar move to the downside for the 30-year bond. That's often seen as a read on inflation expectations. We're going to speak with former Fed Vice Chairman Roger Ferguson in just a moment with his expectations for Powell. And this morning, we're checking gold once again, coming off another record high close. Right now, you can see it's down just fractionally, trading at about basically $2,130 an ounce this morning. And we got to talk about it. Bitcoin, really a wild ride for Bitcoin. It just keeps rolling after very briefly hitting a record all-time high yesterday. Later in the show, we're going to take a deeper look at the rally, and we're going to see if it has any staying power. Remember, Bitcoin trades around the clock. Right now, you can see it's up just over 6.5%, trading pretty much at 66,000, almost 500. Okay, that's your morning money setup. Let's now see if Europe is following our lead this morning. We're going to go over to Erbile Gumede, who's live in our London newsroom with much more on the early action. Erbile, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Frank. Look, what respite might have been in the market from yesterday, well, that certainly hasn't played itself into this trade then today. In this early market trade, markets have been open for 2 hours here in Europe, and you're seeing gains really across the board, finding their footing. Really a lot of upgrades and really market data being at play then today. Of course, the UK is leading towards its budget then, which will be announced in around 2.5 hours' time or so, and we'll be looking straight forward to that. Income tax cuts are anticipated then as well out of that announcement. Really what has been touted, the IMF perhaps not necessarily too happy around that announcement. But let's look at what exactly is moving markets then, and particularly on the sectors front then. What is it that is shifting and shaping things? Well, media stocks are down around 0.5%. Then you do have the likes of TUI, which are getting a bit of an upgrade then as well then to their share price. So that is managing to move prices a little bit higher. On the insurance front, you do see that sitting pretty much flat thus far. But really on the other side of the spectrum, 1.25% higher. Then from the chemicals aspect, then even real estate managing to move up 1.25% to the good. So too retail managing more than 1% of gain. So it does seem that gains are now in play. We had started off the market on a little bit of a shaky ground, but we are finding our feet then across Europe, Frank.
All right, Arabile, thank you very much. Turn our attention now back to Wall Street after yesterday's sell-off, which saw the major averages fall more than 1%, fueled by weakness in the Mag 7 and the chip sector. Our Jim Cramer weighing in on yesterday's action on Mad Money. He says stocks, they may be stretched and hitting their peak, but in his mind, this isn't like the dot-com or housing bubbles that tank the markets.
The first one, the dot-com implosion, destroyed confidence in the stock market for at least a generation, maybe permanently. The second one was systemic, destroying some major financial institutions and leading to the Great Recession. That was truly a horrendous bear market. Now, those were bubbles. Right now, we've got nothing like that. But I'll admit that the market feels toppy, which is worse than frothy and therefore not great.
All right, joining me now is Philip Colmar, Managing Director and Global Strategist at MRB Partners. It's a firm that sets investment strategies for some of the largest pension and hedge funds, as well as multi-asset managers. Philip, great to have you here in the house.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, so you just heard what Jim Cramer said. He said it's toppy, but that's actually worse than frothy in his mind. This is exactly the kind of top-down insights that your clients pay you for. So you're going to get it for free. We're going to get it for free, I should say. Do you agree with Jim Cramer? Is the market, you know, it's a bit toppy, but we're not at a bubble? Or do you see some signs of a bubble in there?
I think it's fragmented. I think that there is elements of a bubble in terms of sort of your mega cap tech stock related stocks. I mean, the expectations of the euphoria surrounding them is pretty elevated at this point. In fact, actually, forward earnings expectations on a multi-year basis really haven't been this high since the dot-com bubble. That being said, the broader index or the broader market doesn't show those bubble characteristics at all, and the economy is still in solid foundations. There's no sense of we're heading in towards a recession that would create that fallout. So I think that there is a difference there.
So when you're advising your clients, we see a lot of economic data. Sometimes it just tells us different stories. For example, the durable goods yesterday, worst report in about 4 years. Then we saw something else when it comes to ISM. How much are you weighing that when you're looking at the market action? How much do you combine the two different things, the economy and the market?
Oh, very much. I mean, that's our research goes from the economy through. If you look at the broad brushstroke of the economy, it is in really good shape. So the household sector is in good shape. The consumption patterns of it is in, and the underlying trend is very solid. If you look at the corporate sector, profits are solid. Business confidence is improving. The employment sector is solid. So we're in a really solid foundation in terms of the U.S. economy. There's nothing in the sense of recessionary or worries in the head. And so we would tie that into a stronger foundation for the equity market as well. Definitely, there's an undercurrent of support. The key is broadening that and diversifying to other sectors.
Yeah, you know, a lot of talk about whether or not it was a bubble yesterday. Actually, a number of notes, Wolf Research, HSBC put out notes. Wolf with a really great note looking at how tech is valued right now compared to how it was at dot-com. Back at dot-com, 48 times forward earnings, now much lower. They're saying not a bubble. Something else we have to talk about, Jay Powell on the Hill today. I imagine a lot of your clients, you laughed right now, a lot of your clients have called you about your expectations. What are you expecting to hear from Jay Powell? In your mind, do you expect him to deviate at all from what he said at the FOMC meeting or what we've heard from Fed officials in recent days?
No, I think he really wants to strike, or he's trying to strike more of a dovish tone. He wants to set the stage for some rate cuts. You know, we're on record for that being a mistake. Like, I think the Fed is completely mischaracterized how low interest or how reduced interest rate sensitive this economy is and the need for rate cuts. They think they need a couple of rate cuts. Right. The truth is the underlying economy is incredibly durable. Inflation is going to come in stronger. I think he's going to signal those rate cuts, but the economy is closing that window for it. So the bond market's going to be, it's already been disappointed, had to price out some rate cuts. It's going to continue to be disappointed. They may be able to squeeze off one or two, but the economy is going to close that window. We're going to get into election cycle. There's a limit to what you want to do just immediately before an election.
So you think he's going to turn more dovish? Because we've kind of heard wait and see. We're still looking at inflation from everybody else, but now you're saying when he comes to the Hill, he gets a little bit more dovish?
No, I think he's in that wait and see. I think that they want to squeeze off the two rate cuts this year. Okay. So he's got a dovish tone to him. That being said, the data, they've already had to admit the data is coming in stronger. It's more durable. Inflation's stickier. They've got to acknowledge some of that. So I think the bond market continues to get disappointment. Okay. I wouldn't say that there's even an outside chance that the window closes on them and they're not able to squeeze off those cuts.
Philip Colmar, great to have you here. We didn't get to this, but one of your sector picks for us was healthcare, up 6% this year. You say it's defensive in a case where we might have higher for longer. Great to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. We're going to move our attention now to the campaign trail following Super Tuesday. President Biden and former President Trump are barreling toward what is expected to be a historic rematch after racking up wins on Super Tuesday. NBC's Bree Jackson joins us now from Washington with much more. Bree, good morning.
Good morning, Frank. So both President Biden and former President Trump dominated Super Tuesday races as they look ahead to the general election. Former President Trump further expanding his delegate lead over his Republican rival, Nikki Haley, picking up decisive wins on Super Tuesday.
They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one.
Haley did win one state, Vermont. She did not make an appearance last night, nor address if she will remain in the race. Her supporters hope so.
I think she's just what we need in this country. I love her message.
Trump is inching closer to clinching the GOP nomination, setting up a rematch with President Biden.
Our cities are being overrun with migrant crime, and that's Biden migrant crime.
The president continues to remain the favorite on the Democratic side. Biden even beat his top challenger, Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips, in his own district.
We got to stick with Joe and his team, and they're doing the right thing.
But concerns remain about the president's low approval ratings. Some voters expressed frustration with his handling of the Israel-Hamas war.
It's making me not want to vote for Joe Biden, honestly. I'm thinking of going third party because of it.
Other Americans are not happy with their main option.
I don't like Trump's approach to people, how negative he is and how he treats others and some of his antics.
It's such a divided country. I'm tired of it being divided. I'd rather be somewhere in the middle.
Both Trump and Biden have more than half of the delegates needed to secure their party's nomination. And both President Biden and former President Trump are set to hold events in Georgia this weekend. That state holds primary elections next Tuesday. Frank?
All right, so Bree, certainly Super Tuesday was a big day. Also, President Trump having a big night. We're also following some reports right now that former President Trump, he met with one of the world's richest people. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, that's right, Frank. So according to The New York Times, the former president met with Elon Musk on Sunday in Florida, along with three other wealthy Republican donors, all unnamed. Now, NBC News has yet to be able to confirm this story, but neither Trump nor Musk responded to requests for comments. It's still unclear if Musk plans to donate to the former president's campaign. But it looks like the former president is looking to garner financial support as he looks ahead to the general election.
All right, our Bree Jackson live in D.C. Bree, always great to see you. Thank you very much. All right, we got a lot more to come here on Worldwide Exchange, including the one word that investors have to know today. But first, getting set for Jay Powell's two-day Capitol Hill testimony, we're going to speak with former Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Roger Ferguson on what Powell needs to say to reset investor expectations. Plus, much more on Bitcoin's record rally, and it's just a spectacular sell-off. We dig into whether that sector has what it takes to hold these levels for the long term. And then later, OpenAI fires back at Elon Musk in his lawsuit claiming the AI leader has lost its way. The bombshell blog post and previously unseen emails, all that's coming up when Worldwide Exchange returns. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to Worldwide Exchange. OpenAI is firing back at Elon Musk over his lawsuit claiming the now Microsoft-backed AI giant has lost its way. Our Pippa Stevens is here with that story. Pippa, over to you.
Good morning, Frank. Well, OpenAI is hitting back at Elon Musk, releasing emails from as far back as 2015 to show that the Tesla boss originally supported a plan to create a for-profit entity and raise billions of dollars by partnering with an already established tech giant. Two decisions at the heart of Musk's lawsuit against the AI startup, alleging it had breached an agreement by forming its multi-billion dollar alliance with Microsoft. Now, in a blog post published late last night, founding members of OpenAI, including Sam Altman, Greg Brockman, and Ilya Sutskever, illustrated it was Musk himself who spearheaded efforts to raise billions of dollars, attach the company to a, quote, cash cow like Tesla, and all in efforts to keep up with who Musk saw as the biggest leader in AI at the time, of course, Google. In an email dated December 26, 2018, Musk told his fellow co-founders, quote, "My probability assessment of OpenAI being relevant to DeepMind /Google without a dramatic change in execution and resources is 0%, not 1%. I wish it were otherwise. Even raising several hundred million won't be enough. This needs billions per year immediately or forget it. And Frank, the team at OpenAI adding they are sad it's come to this with someone whom they deeply admired and inspired them to aim higher. You know, I don't think this is the end of the story. There is more to come here.
There always seems to be more to every single story he's involved in. So, you know, the saga continues. And Pippa, you're going to continue, too. We'll see you later in the show. All right. Turn our attention now to our big money movers. We're going to start off with CrowdStrike surging on an earnings beat and strong full year guidance. Revenue rising by 36% as more companies double down on cyber attacks. Shares are up more than 23% right now. This stock has really been a juggernaut, up over 130% over the past year and firmly in positive territory so far this year, outpacing the First Trust cybersecurity ETF through both of those timeframes. Shares of Nordstrom, though, they're selling off this morning. The retailer warning of a potential sales decline between 1% and 2% this year. Changing consumer trends and higher levels of markdowns weighing on Nordstrom, along with the wind down of its Canadian business. Quite a few factors. Shares are down more than 9%. Box posting its first $1 billion fiscal year and announcing a $100 million share buyback program. The software company also unveiling new large language models designed for Microsoft Azure. CEO Aaron Levy says AI will become core to the platform and a major reason to adopt Box. Those shares up just over 2%. All right, coming up on Worldwide Exchange. Signs the regional reckoning, it may be over as investors flock back into shares of New York Community Bank. We speak with another key player in the space with a firsthand look at what's really going on. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to Worldwide Exchange. Shares of New York Community Bank, they're moving higher again this morning after jumping 18% yesterday and coming off their lowest levels since 1996. The stock, however, still down 68% this year on concerns about loans and commercial real estate exposure. This coming just days before the one-year anniversary of the Silicon Valley Bank collapse. The KRE Regional Banking ETF is down about 6% since then. Joining me now with what he's seeing is Jim Ryan, chairman and CEO of Old National Bank Corp, the sixth largest commercial bank in the Midwest. Jim, it is great to have you here. We've been talking to you on Zoom quite a bit. Great to have you here in the studio.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, so Jim, you had earnings in late January, record EPS, core deposit growth of 4%. So overall, a strong quarter. Your stock jumped on the report, and we're going to show the chart here. Then we saw some fluctuations. So you had a strong quarter. We see the fluctuations. How much does New York Community Bank and the issues there, how much do they affect your investor confidence and also your customer confidence?
Yeah, I think early on the reports were a little bit like reopening the wounds from last March and April. And so unfortunately, all bank stocks really took a dive after that. Having said that, I've just come off the road and meeting with 40 plus investors and a bunch of CEOs. And I think we all think it's relatively isolated here. Mm-hmm. So I think investors are gaining confidence. Interestingly enough, too, long-term investors and generalist investors are starting to come back and look at the space. I think they're doing their homework right now, not quite ready to get back in. But I'm hopeful at some point we get a little more clarity around interest rates. We get a little more clarity around the election. And we might see a better bid for bank stocks.
So you're mentioning interest rates. How closely do you watch Jay Powell's testimony on Capitol Hill today and obviously tomorrow?
I think we're all looking for signs.
Well, what's the sign that you're looking for? I mean, what's the most important thing to you? Is it simply the cuts or is it some of the other runoff of the balance sheet that you're looking at? I mean, what are the key issues for a regional bank like
yours? I think most banks are looking for one to possibly three cuts total this year. It's looking less and less likely. Those cuts would help us lower deposit costs and ultimately drive to better earnings per share.
It would lower deposit costs, but would it have other impacts on your business? I mean, a lot of people are flocking to these money markets and sometimes these high yield savings accounts because they don't want the risk of the market, but they want to get some kind of return.
Yeah, I think it has the potential. But I think also that sense of easing, I think, might give a nice strong boost to the economy, which tends to be weakening right now at this point in time. It's not a lot softer, but it's a little bit softer than where it's been. And I think it's more of a confidence booster than anything else.
All right. So you took us to the Fed and what they might do. I want to come back to New York Community Bank. Their real issue was commercial real estate, specifically multifamilies, rent control buildings in New York City. You're in the Midwest. It's a very different real estate market, both when it comes to commercial real estate for retail and things like that, but also when it comes to multifamilies, not so much rent control. It's just a different place. Give us a sense. What's your commercial loan exposure when it comes to multifamily and also for retail and industrial, et cetera?
We do a fair amount of multifamily lending, but it's really strong. Even, again, when we go back and look at these loans years after doing the original underwriting and looking at rates that are up 300 basis points, because they've been able to push through rate increases, actually, our multifamily product has performed incredibly well, and there continues to be this structural deficit. There's more demand for housing than there is housing available. So for us, it's still a segment we continue to loan and invest in.
Okay.
And it's performing incredibly well.
So you continue to loan and invest in it, but how do you gauge the risk? How do you mitigate the risk? Because we continue to hear it's a risk. We're looking at the KRE down 6% year over year, just about at the one-year anniversary of the Silicon Valley Bank issue, which had nothing to do with commercial real estate, but still highlighted the issue. How do you deal with that?
You know, so for us, it's picking the right clients. Client selection matters. Looking at those markets that maybe have still capacity to build, and not getting the issues, I believe, tend to be isolated in a few markets that have been overbuilt over the last handful of years. And in the Midwest, by and large, particularly suburban multifamily products, are going to continue to hold up incredibly well.
Jim, it is really great to have you here. Serious topic. We didn't get to this, but you just did the Chicago Polar Plunge. If you look on my LinkedIn or your LinkedIn, you'll see a pretty funny picture. We got to stick to the serious business right now. We're showing it. We're actually showing it.
Oh, I love it.
Jim, really appreciate your insight when it comes to the regional banking sector and your bank. And thanks for taking me into the Polar Plunge. I physically was not going to go there, but you brought me in spirit. It's great to have you and your family here. Thanks again. All right, coming up here at Worldwide Exchange, record high and record slide. Tracking the action of Bitcoin this morning after the very brief moment when anyone who's ever invested in Bitcoin turned a profit. We'll be right back on Worldwide Exchange. Stay with us. It is right around 5:30 a.m. in the New York City area, and there's a lot more ahead here on Worldwide Exchange. Here's what's still on deck. Stocks looking to shake off another losing session, with the Mag 7 shedding more than $200 billion in market cap in yesterday's sell-off. Futures right now, they're working to build a bit of a bounce back. Bitcoin facing whipsaw action after touching a fresh record high. We're going to dig into the factors fueling the rebound and whether it can test new highs. And Fed Chairman Jay Powell set to kick off 2 days of testimony to Congress as investors look for the latest clues on if and when the Fed may start to ease rates. It is Wednesday, March the 6th, 2024. You are watching Worldwide Exchange right here on CNBC. And welcome back to Worldwide Exchange. I'm Frank Holland. Let's get you ready for the trading day ahead. We pick up the half an hour with a check of U.S. stock futures after Wall Street's worst day since February the 13th. Take a look. We're in the green across the board. The Dow hitting looks like its highs of this morning. Looks like it would open up about 80 points higher. NASDAQ moving higher as well, partly on that really strong CrowdStrike report. What we're seeing here, very different than what we saw yesterday. Big sell-off yesterday. Worst day since February 13th. Take a look. It was even worse for the Mag 7. Tesla, the hardest hit, down almost 4%. Apple down almost 3%. The Mag 7, if you take out NVIDIA, losing a combined $233 billion in market value yesterday, which in part fueled the broader market sell-off. We're also checking the bond market this morning ahead of today's Capitol Hill testimony from Fed Chairman Jay Powell. Taking a look at yields, the benchmark right now coming in at 4.15%. We've seen the benchmark decline about 10 basis points from its highs at the start of the month. Similar story for the long bond, the 30-year, often seen as a read on inflation expectations. In a moment, we're going to speak with former Vice Chairman, Fed Vice Chairman Roger Ferguson on his expectations for today's testimony from Jay Powell. We're also checking gold once again this morning, coming off another record high close. Right now, you can see it's down fractionally, down almost a third of a percent, trading basically at $2,130 an ounce right now. You can see, though, still very close to its record high. So, again, we'll continue to watch gold and some other factors that are moving the market throughout this morning. Okay, that is your morning money setup. Now, we want to turn our attention to Capitol Hill and Fed Chairman Jay Powell, set to begin 2 days of testimony before Congress when he speaks with the House Financial Services Committee starting at 10 a.m. Eastern time today. His testimony coming on the heels of a growing chorus of comments from other Fed officials making the case against near-term interest rate cuts, including Vice Chair Philip Jefferson, who warned late last month the danger of easing too much in response to inflation improvements. Also, Governor Christopher Waller, who says there's just no rush to begin cutting interest rates to normalize monetary policy, considering the latest batch of economic data. Joining me now with more is someone who's been in the room when this all happens, former Fed Reserve Vice Chairman and former TIA CEO Roger Ferguson. You're also a CNBC contributor. And Roger, it is great to have you here on a morning like this.
Great. Nice to be here with you.
All right. So give us a sense. Take us into the room. Take us into what you think Jay Powell is thinking right now. What are your expectations for his testimony on Capitol Hill today? Do you believe he'll deviate at all from what he said during the last FOMC meeting or what we've been hearing recently? We just mentioned what we're hearing from Fed officials.
I think he'll stick very much to what he's heard from his colleagues, what the market has heard from his colleagues. I think he's going to reinforce the no rush to cut message, which was being delivered by many for a variety of good reasons. I think he likes the way market is probably set up right now, expecting, you know, cuts, if any, later in the year, and probably fewer than had been planned or expected in the market, you know, earlier this year. I think he's going to comment on the data, but in a way that says basically things are developing as expected. You know, the economy might be slowing a little bit, but consumers continue to be, you know, healthy, and, you know, inflation is coming down. I always expected that to be uneven, so he'll nod to the January CPI. I don't think he wants to get too much out ahead of that sort of data, because there's data coming up later this week and next week, unemployment report and the CPI next week. So I think he wants to stay close to the past data. Those are, I think, the two major messages.
So he's going to stay close to the past data, but I'm sure, you know, when he's on Capitol Hill, he's going to get a lot of questions about the data coming up. How does he respond to questions about the path of inflation? Because I think a lot of people just in the secular world feel like inflation is definitely coming down, but we keep getting this pushback from Fed officials.
I think he's going to say that the Fed inflation actually is coming down, but importantly, you know, the path of inflation coming down is uneven. There's still some risks of an upside surprise. I think you'll observe the January data, the CPI, maybe came in a little hotter than many had expected. So I don't think he wants to feed into the notion that it's going to be just one way, because he doesn't know what the February data are going to bring, and it could be a surprise either way. But I think he wants to stick to the overall theme that, you know, the inflation number is looking healthier, which is why they have the possibility of setting up for cuts a little later. You know, and finally, I think he's going to want to reinforce the possibility, the hope of a soft landing, but I don't think he's going to jump to a commitment that we're going to get there. I think he's still going to talk about, you know, some risks on both sides there.
Really? I think a lot of people feel like we're already in a Goldilocks situation, but we'll have to wait and see what he says. So we just had a regional bank CEO on just a short time ago. He said he's listening very closely. One thing I know that he's listening for, I would imagine the street and maybe Congress people are looking for, more clarity on the balance sheet runoff when it comes to the Fed. What are you expecting when it comes to that?
I think he's going to say that that is working smoothly, and it's not quite an automatic pilot, but it's not the main tool that they're using. So don't look to see dramatic shifts there. He will also say, you know, if need be, if liquidity conditions call for, they can slow it down a little bit. So I think he's going to be what I describe as sort of soothing around the balance sheet. He does not want the balance sheet discussion to be a source of instability in markets. And I think he believes that the best way to keep it from being instability causing is just to be very, very clear that it's going to continue on exactly the same path it's followed in the past, unless something unexpected happens.
You know, overall, the economy seems pretty strong. We did have that weak durable goods number yesterday. Also, the market is moving higher, hitting new highs in a variety of different sectors. We're seeing that broadening. Does that matter to Jay Powell? Does that something that he takes into consideration when he's not only talking to Congress, but when we're going to eventually get this rate decision?
Look, I think the underlying strength of the economy absolutely does matter. He will also be wise to not put too much weight on any one reading, because some have been a little softer, as you point out. Some have been a little firmer. Vis-a-vis the equity markets, it doesn't matter directly. I don't think he's trying to move the equity market one way or the other. It matters indirectly for this concept of, you know, financial conditions. And that, you know, will be the financial conditions continue to be consistent with a pretty good outlook for the economy. So I think, you know, that's one of the things that factors into why is there no rush to cut, because, you know, financial conditions are supportive of ongoing growth. And one of those is obviously, you know, how equity markets are moving. The other is interest rates are set by the market, and I would say the 10-year and the 30-year both are moving in ways that probably suggest, you know, a pretty good outlook for everybody.
Yeah, a lot going on here. I think all eyes will be on Jay Powell. Testimony begins at 10 a.m. Eastern time. Roger Ferguson, always great to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, turn our attention now to Bitcoin, looking to get back to that all-time high after hitting 69,210 for the first time ever yesterday. Then it quickly pulled back. Take a look right now. You see it's trading at pretty much 66,550. So the milestone yesterday coming more than a year after the collapse of FTX rattled just the entire crypto space. For much more, let's bring in CNBC.com technology reporter Mackenzie Sagalos. Mac, it's great to have you here. A lot of enthusiasm around Bitcoin. Hit a new record high yesterday. Got a couple questions for you. What's moving us higher? How big of a factor are institutional investors? We saw the Bitcoin ETFs launch. How much are retail investors? So much enthusiasm out there. Our EP was just out in Vegas. He said, first question from a cab driver, are you in Bitcoin? So, I mean, what's moving Bitcoin higher right now?
And that is typically your, you know, classic story of hitting a peak bubble moment. But what's different this time around is that institutional money is here in a way that it wasn't during past bull runs. The spot ETFs have both solidified Bitcoin's place as an asset class, but they've also been setting new records. Collectively, in the last 2 months, those 10 U.S. spot Bitcoin ETFs have brought in $50 billion. You look at BlackRock's iShares Bitcoin Trust. It is the fastest that an ETF has gone from zero to $10 billion in assets. So clearly institutional money is a game changer. But there are other things happening under the hood, so to speak. You've got these technological advancements that are apparently going to put Bitcoin on par with Ethereum. So a lot of developers are flooding into Bitcoin in a way that they haven't in the past.
Oh, so like a real use case for Bitcoin. Because like a lot of times there's arguments like, does it have a use case? Is it currency? Is it stored value? But you're saying developers are finding more use cases.
Oh, right. I mean, Bitcoin has actually been proud of the fact historically that it's kind of a boring commodity. It's stable, is the store of value, something you can rely on in that sense. But I've been talking to a lot of coders in this ecosystem and a lot of VCs. I was just out in Denver talking to A16Z Crypto's chief, Chris Dixon. And there's so much enthusiasm around these so-called layer two companies. Yeah. So basically all the startups building on top of Bitcoin.
All right. By the way, I like the name drop. A16, Chris Dixon. I like that one. So you're taking us under the hood. Explain this to us. The halving. It sounds almost like a horror movie, like the halving. It's bad. But it's actually generally a tailwind when it comes to Bitcoin and actually all of cryptocurrency, right?
Yeah. So in a couple of weeks from now, this market making event called the halving, which happens roughly every 4 years, is going to cut the production of new Bitcoin in half. It is something that is baked into Bitcoin's code, and it's meant to be a deflationary measure. And it kind of goes to this larger narrative of part of why Bitcoin is doing so well is basic supply demand economics, right? You've got spot ETFs buying up Bitcoin. You're about to have new Bitcoin production cut in half. And then all these startups that are building on top of Bitcoin actually have the effect of scooping up supply. So it's all kind of moving in Bitcoin's favor with respect to price.
All right. So Bitcoin's hitting new highs. It's pullback, obviously. But when you see those kind of moves, investors generally look in the crypto space for other opportunities. What's the other area that investors are looking at for opportunities right now?
So what brought me out to Denver was actually this ETH Denver event, 20,000 people kind of coming in. And the biggest narrative out of that, Frank, was an upgrade coming in a couple of weeks from now, which is going to slash transaction costs by up to 90%. And that is a game changer with respect to what coders can build on top of Ethereum. So we're talking about decentralized social media apps, gaming. There are going to be these use cases that just weren't possible before because it was too cost prohibitive.
All right. Mackenzie Sagalos on all things crypto. Mac, great to have you here. Thank you. All right. Coming up here on Worldwide Exchange, American taxpayers forking over millions to keep a Russian yacht running. Robert Frank explains how what was supposed to be a windfall for the U.S. government, it's now become a growing cost. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to Worldwide Exchange. Time now for your morning call sheet. We start with Morgan Stanley cutting its price target on Tesla to $320 per share. It cites in part falling EV demand and an oversupplied Chinese EV market. You are seeing Tesla shares, however, move higher in the pre-market. HSBC upgrading its rating on target on the back of earnings to buy, citing higher EPS and updated guidance from the retailer. Shares of Target up just over 0.25%. And Berenberg upgrading its rating on Honeywell to a buy, citing an extended underperformance versus its peers and estimates, and now believes that Honeywell can beat shares of Honeywell, fractionally lower right now in the pre-market. All right, turn our attention now to a story of intrigue on the high seas. It's being fought in a U.S. courtroom, and American taxpayers, they look like they're footing the bill. Robert Frank joins us now with more on a super yacht that may or may not be owned by a super rich Russian oligarch. This is definitely a Frank and Frank, Robert. I got lots of questions, but you go first.
Well, Frank, great to see you this morning. You know, 2 years ago, U.S. authorities commandeered a 348-foot yacht in Fiji. The yacht's name was Amadea. Authorities say it is owned by Suleiman Karimov. He's the sanctioned Russian billionaire who made his fortune in mining. U.S. Marshals sailed it back to San Diego, and they began forfeiture proceedings to take possession and hopefully sell it. It was all part of that global dragnet to capture the private jets, the yachts, the mansions of all those Russian oligarchs and use the cash to fund Ukraine's war effort. Well, turns out it wasn't that simple. Oligarchs are masters at cloaking their ownership through shell companies and straw owners. And attorneys for Edward Kudinetov, he's a non-sanctioned Russian billionaire, say he, in fact, is Amadea's owner. The U.S. says he's just a proxy owner and that emails from the yacht crew prove that Karimov, in fact, is the owner. Meantime, the U.S. government and us taxpayers have to pay the maintenance on Amadea as it sits in San Diego. That maintenance now totals nearly $1 million a month. It includes $360,000 a month for crew, $75,000 for fuel, $165,000 for food and waste removal, other expenses. It also includes insurance, that's a lot, and dry dock repairs. Now, so far, the U.S. has spent over $20 million to maintain this boat. The U.S. asking a court to sell it, valued at over $230 million, because they call the fees excessive and they don't want to pay it anymore, understandably, Frank.
I mean, Robert, this is an amazing story. So first off, why are we maintaining it? Why can't it just sit there? Like, why would you need $165,000 in food and waste management?
Yachts are very expensive. And if you don't maintain them, you don't clean them, you don't wash them, you don't maintain all the mechanics, they rapidly lose their value. And this is a boat that's valued at somewhere between $230 and $300 million. So the amount that, yes, you're paying a lot to maintain it, but you would lose even more if you didn't maintain it and you just let it rot. And so, you know, the U.S. government is learning just how expensive these boats are to maintain.
Yeah, I think we all are as taxpayers. So they're asking a court for basically permission to sell it. When is that ruling expected to come down? And I'm asking for a friend right now. Would they take buy now, pay later?
I don't know about that, but the attorneys for the yacht, the holding company, have basically tried to stall and extend this as long as possible. So, you know, we don't really know. What could happen is they would sell it, and then that money wouldn't immediately go to the government. They would then fight over those proceeds. And so even if they sold it in a week, it could be months or even years before the U.S. actually got the money.
Wow. Quite a story. Our yacht, believed to be owned by a Russian oligarch, costing us, the taxpayers, millions. Robert Frank, another great story. Always great to see you. All right, coming up here on Worldwide Exchange, we have the one word that every investor needs to know today, plus the signals. Our next guest is suggesting continued strength ahead for the markets. That's despite yesterday's sell-off. We'll be right back on Worldwide Exchange with much more. Welcome back to Worldwide Exchange. It's time now for your WEX wrap-up. We start with Donald Trump and President Biden all but locking in their presidential race rematch, both winning big on Super Tuesday. This is the New York Times reports. Trump also met over the weekend with Elon Musk, seeking a cash infusion for his campaign. And speaking of Elon Musk, OpenAI responding to his lawsuit with a handful of old emails showing that Elon Musk urged the startup to raise at least $1 billion and avoid sharing information with the public. Elon Musk is alleging OpenAI's secrecy is driven by profit over safety. The Mag 7 shedding, coming off a pretty rough session, shedding $233 billion in market cap in just one single day. This was only its third worst single day loss this year, however, just to keep it all in perspective. China's central bank governor says there's more room to cut reserve requirements for banks. He also plans to use monetary policy to mildly stimulate consumer prices. And BYD further igniting the EV price war in China, cutting the price of its cheapest car by 5%. Other automakers, including Tesla, Geely, and XPeng, have also rolled out fresh cuts this year, though not to the degree of BYD's. All right, here's what to watch today. We get weekly mortgage applications as well as the latest ADP and JOLTS figures ahead of Friday's monthly jobs report. Then on the earnings front, we get results from Campbell Soup, Abercrombie & Fitch, and Victoria's Secret. And then what may be the highlight of this day, Fed Chairman Jay Powell kicks off 2 days of congressional testimony. That's at 10 a.m. Eastern, going before the House Financial Services Committee. All right, stocks are coming off back-to-back negative sessions with losses from the Mag 7 dragging down the broader markets. Take a look at futures right now. We are seeing them in the green across the board, the Dow, off of its highs of earlier, but still looks like it would open up about 70 points higher. For much more, let's bring in Courtney Garcia, Senior Wealth Advisor at Payne Capital Management, also a CNBC contributor. Courtney, good morning. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we saw that big sell-off on the market yesterday, futures indicating a bit of a rebound today. How do you see today shaping up? What's your WEX word of the day?
Yeah, and our word of the day today is booming, because we remain in the camp that the markets are continuing this booming bull market here. And I think when you look at the broader data, the market continues and the economy in general continues to be on good footing, right? Ultimately, we're coming off of an earnings season right now where over 90% of companies have reported earnings. There's been over 5% increase in earnings quarter over quarter, and they've beat expectations by about 8%. We're getting the JOLTS numbers out today, unemployment report Friday, which is likely going to show we're in the continued tight labor market, which is a great thing for the economy. We also saw last quarter there's over $205 billion in stock buybacks, which historically is a bullish sign for the markets. And inflation continues to come in line with expectations. I think for all of those reasons, it's a really good backdrop that the markets will continue to go higher. So seeing a day like yesterday where you have a bit of a pullback, I think is normal. But ultimately, we do think the markets are going to continue in the upwards direction.
All right. So you're saying all this is normal again. We want to highlight this again. The third biggest pullback for Magnificent Seven this year. It's only the third, but it was still $233 billion in market cap loss. So in your mind, when it comes to big tech and the Magnificent Seven, is this a buying opportunity or is this a wait and see situation?
Yeah, when you point out yesterday the pullback, it was mostly in the Magnificent Seven. And I think what we want to take a look at is the broader market. So we own the Magnificent Seven. It's not something that we want to get out of. I think you're probably going to see it go higher. It's also not something I'm jumping into. If you look at the top 10 holdings, the S&P 500, the average price to earnings ratio is about 25 times, which is historically expensive. But there's plenty of other areas, like take energy and utilities, for example. They trade significantly below their 10-year averages. And that's what you want to look at is, yes, I want to own those things, but there's plenty of other buying opportunities here and plenty of other sectors that are going to continue in that upwards direction. So make sure you're well diversified. I'm not saying get out of tech, but I'm also not saying to chase it here.
You know, you mentioned materials. I know that's something that you're looking at as a longer term play, but I'm just looking recently over the last month. Materials, the best performing sector, up over 6.5%. So in your mind, the long term play for materials, what are you looking at there? Are you looking at individual stocks and materials? Do you just want to play the sector more broadly? Is there an ETF? How do you play it?
Yeah, and we use ETFs because we want to play the sector more broadly. And materials is something that I think has become underappreciated, because this year it's expected to be one of maybe the lagging sectors when you look at earnings. But next year, when you look at 2025, and again, remember that stocks are forward looking, the earnings are actually expected to be one of the higher growing sectors. And you do want to get in there before those earnings go up, not after. It's something you want to get into sooner rather than later.
Got to talk about it. Jay Powell on Capitol Hill today and also tomorrow. What are your expectations? How does it impact potentially your investment thesis?
Honestly, I think we're probably going to see more of the same. I don't think they're going to give us any indication that rates are coming down immediately. As much as the markets would like to see that, I think it is still going to be a little while longer here. And they have put so much work to get the economy where it is now and everything they've done on rates. I don't think they're going to indicate that they're actually lowering them until they're ready to do so. So I think you're going to see more of the same here. But I think when you look at the markets, whether they're lowering rates in March, which clearly isn't happening, or later this year, the bigger picture story is eventually rates are coming down, which will be a good thing for the economy. And as long as inflation continues in expectations, which they are, it's a good thing.
All right, Courtney Garcia from Payne Capital. Great to see you as always. Thank you for being here. That's going to do it for us. Squawk Box is coming up next. You've been listening to CNBC's Worldwide Exchange. You can always catch us live weekdays at 5 a.m. Eastern.